See, there's that state of mind too, that, you know, like with literal thinking, you know, you can look at something, you can say, you can look at Darwinian theory, and you can say, you look at, you know, the world's been here, or the universe has been here, you know, for 15 billion years. And it's that state of mind that you come to it from. So if you come to wanting to believe that or disbelieve it, you know, your question is in doubt first. So if you come to the question, you know, with a positiveness and saying you want to learn something here, or you come with a negative saying, you know, I want you to prove to me something, that unless it's up to you to seek further into it, anything I say would be wrong,
yeah,
you know, to you.
Yes.
And unless I actually speak your language, and I have to know you to know that,
yes,
then I can answer it in a way that you'll accept it, but it might not necessarily be truth, but it'll be a truth that fits into what you know.
Yes.
That's a very good point. It's actually in the area of what I understand by faith. You know, faith that you're actually going to gain from looking at things in another person's way and have faith in that, rather than to sort of come into opposition.
Maybe the first question should be, why are you asking me this
question? Yes.
Is it for your gain, my gain, or just to create an argument for what I'm going to say?
Yeah.
So,
well, I was thinking of the person that's interested, but can be dissuaded by something a little shonky. Right, so you can, that's why it's good to have a solid base to argue from,
yeah,
and a point of view that takes into account where are they. So, because otherwise the truth is, yeah, you know, you're drunk. Yeah. It doesn't make any sense what you're saying. I just thought of something as well, Joe, when you were saying about the structure. You know, if you're going to look at it from a scientific point of view, you could look at it from, you know, this great thing that's come up, risk management. What are the risks if I take this to be true? Well, the risks are quite clear, mate. The risks are you're going to be friendly, you're going to love more, you're going to be kind, you're going to be...
Oh, okay. No, that won't work.
So, right, so those are the risks. No, there are no risks for humanity if you take that viewpoint. If you take the literal viewpoint, the risks are you're going to become bigoted, you're going to start burning Korans, you know, because it says here in black and white.
Yeah.
So that's the risk of that side, but the risk of being Swedenborgian and looking at it from that point of view...
Hopelessness, isolation, hatred
is life, which is the very first thing David said.
Funny enough you should say that, because that's exactly why I'm sitting here. Because I took that argument with myself and go like, okay, is it embarrassment or whatever? I could, you know, what is the risk of just taking on face value some of these points? There aren't really any. Might become a nicer person. Yeah.
I really appreciate the way in which the construct of existence is full of, you know, whether you look at ancient people or Jesus Christ, or the universe, or whatever. It's full of imponderables. And I actually think these are God's smiles, he puts it poetically, where God is saying, you know, okay, make sense of this. And delight in the effort to do so. And that's all part of the dance. And I think that's wonderful. But we can turn that into frustration and, you know, confrontation. But to actually dance in the unknowingness. And occasionally get, as I believe all of us have, occasionally get some ooh-ers descend, which make the dance even more tantalising in that sense. Okay, I want to keep you in the 17 minutes left, which we will not complete. I want to give you my selected passages. So, in fact, what I'll do the bottom sheet is my list of the 7 points I raised. So if you can actually give those out, and you can give those out. Well, you should have 2.5 pages of numbered quotes.
Well, you've only got a page.
You should have four sheets.
Oh, sorry.
Four sheets. Whoa, three pages and a fourth.
Sorry.
They're already collated.
They're already collated.
This could take 7 minutes. What I have done is generally take out passages that touch on this idea of the connection between up with God, in whatever sense that you mean that, and down in life, in terms of you know, applying it, doing it, being it, using it, and so on. Some of these I think are absolutely delightful. I'll just pick a few out. I like the first one very much. This is Swedenborg talking about the opening idea. I think it's in verse 2, where they worship from afar.
Verse 1,
and worship from afar. Come up to the Lord and bring the others, 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. But Moses alone shall come near the Lord. So you get this hierarchy of Moses, a band of people, and all the people worshipping from afar. Now, this is a classic example, and David will nod to this, David Miller. This is a classic example where the image of distance is nothing to do with distance. It's to do with a state that we are beneficially able to be in. I'll just read it. And worship from afar. This explains why worship from afar means not only humility and adoration from the heart, but also the inflowing of the Lord at the same time. The words inflowing of the Lord are used because the good of love and of faith which flows in from the Lord is the Lord as he resides with a person. The reason why from afar means coming from the heart is that when people feel humble, they draw back from the Lord because they do not consider themselves worthy to draw near God most holy. For when they feel humble, they recognize that left to themselves, they're nothing but evil, indeed nothing but profanity. Now, that seems to go against what I was saying earlier on about, you know, putting yourself down and sort of self-loathing. But it's this wonderful sense of, I'm in connection with God, always have been, always will be. And if I, for some reason, were to actually lose that, I would be so self-centered and profane, it would be unbelievable. And that just makes, I say, it makes you go very quiet. That's the humility and that state of heart of, you know, not ever so humble, but actually withholding. What I would add to this is the wonder in life of encountering people, and I'm not one of them, I'm afraid, encountering people who communicate so much by saying so little. And I call that, you know, humility. And they don't have to show, prove, they just be. And I think that's a wonderful statement. It's sort of akin to this idea of humility, knowing that if you are not in that connection with God, were it ever, which of course it can't be, but your awareness of it can be, if it were ever to be lost sight of, you would be nothing but evil, nothing but profanity. And, you know, I just feel this is very, very experiential.
It strikes me there are very different selves involved in this humility self to the self which criticises another self for, you know, what you were talking about before, where you're really whipping yourself over something, over not being perfect or over not being this. You know,
very
one
different.
Self against another, but they're different selves at a lower state than the one who truly recognises, here's me, but it's really God that does through me.
Which, of course, is the transformed self. Mm. Okay? The transformed self is radiant, as Moses was at one point, radiant and manifesting, just true being. Mm. Okay? True being, because of the flow through. And that means you are just able to be in that, which is true humility.
Yeah.
It's what Jesus called, he who loses his life for my sake shall find it. What do you mean? He who loses his life enters and becomes self-forgetful, in that true sense, finds life, because you're not having to justify who you are and win points and things.
Lose the identification with all those little selves that vie against each other being the king for the day.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, move on. 9382. That's a sign. Sorry, I've got water. I've got water on, and I'm okay. I won't die on the spot.
We're going to listen from afar, all right?
Oh, good man. Thank you, Mark. You're going to listen from afar. I may be contagious. Shut up, Julie. Thank you. Thank you, Caroline. And Moses came and reported to the people means enlightenment from the Lord imparted through divine truth which springs from him. Everyone receives enlightenment and instruction from the word according to his affection for it, desire for it, and ability to receive it, which being so, they establish themselves guidelines to which they then relate the literal sense. Okay?
One of the Melbourne talks, association talks, a person came and talked about the ox herding pictures, Buddhist, ten steps, which is just what we're talking about, spiritual development. And one, I don't know which step it was, but one of them was, and then you ride the ox playing your flute, and people will come to listen and follow the ox and follow, I think the ox or you, I can't remember. But that's the same thing. Your life, lived to these principles, speaks and enlightens other people. What does he believe in? That's, I really like him. Where does he get his strength from? And that's what I think is what that's saying, isn't it? That your life is the example. Your enlightenment, whatever you got of it, can help others.
It's empowering.
Others.
Empowering others.
Yes.
Let your light so shine before men.
And according to their affection for it. So it's up to them still. You're not badgering anyone.
9386, and Moses wrote and Moses wrote all Jehovah's words. As soon as you see write, prick your ears up and think bringing it into existence.
book
writing it down so that it now exists.
Absorbing it.
Book of life, is it?
The act of ultimate expression.
Ultimating it. And then you have Moses taking half the blood and putting it in bowls. Now, blood is the symbol of life, whereas often it's taken to be the symbol of suffering and sacrifice and death. the more that you can actually see biblical blood, including Jesus Christ, as a symbol of life flowing, the more accurate you're going to see the meaning from it. Because it's not suffering, it's life empowering. And the blood is... Moses took half the blood. And Moses took, who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half the blood and put it in basins, and half the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And Moses took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, "This is the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you, according to these words." Now, I want to read 9:3:9:3 and 9:3:9:4.
You want me to read them?
No. It's getting better by the second. 9:3:9:3 and 9:3:9:4, which also goes over the page. "And Moses took half of the blood," means divine truth, which has become a matter of life and worship. "For it was this blood which was sprinkled on the people." Worship springing from truth, which goes out from the will and from affection and love, is worship, and is called worship of the heart. "And put it in bowls," means present with a person in the things of his memory, for bowls are vessels, which mean known facts, things you're conscious of. Here, the bowls hold blood, which are God's truths. "All the things which are learned and stored in the memory, from where they can be called forth before the sight of the understanding, are called known facts. In themselves, they're things which make up the understanding of the natural or external person. Since known facts include items of knowing concerning inner realities, they serve the sight of the internal or rational person as a sort of mirror." In other words, you need to have a bowl of facts, life, understanding that you know, that's got to be there, into which divine truth can actually come in and give life to. That's important. Now, carrying on, "For they then become things that can be seen by the internal person, just as fields full of plants or delightful gardens are seen in the material world by the external person. But internal sight, which is the understanding, sees in those same fields or gardens forming the memory only those things which are in keeping with the loves that govern a person and which are also in agreement with the chief ideas he loves." Okay? So they used the associations, the known facts become pegs, become
anchors.
Become
anchors?
Anchors, become catalysts, and so on. "Furthermore, when known facts or things in the memory become part of a person's life, they fade from his external memory in the same way other things do when continual practice or habit makes them spontaneous and instinctive, so to speak." And I thought, wow, that's nice. It's like switching. Known facts, make sure they're there. Make sure you think about life. How do you deal with people? What are you going to do? How are you going to serve things? What's life like? Known fact. Comes into that, enlivens it, and takes over so that the known facts actually become less important, because now you're actually in the doing so much that it becomes spontaneous and instinctive, so to speak.
Do you want to hear something nice? Mm-hmm.
It's like a summary.
I looked up Nadab. Right?
Nadab.
Yeah. And so Nadab and Abihu represent teachings. You've got Moses and Aaron. Moses' external truth, internal truth, Aaron is external truth from the word, and Nadab and Abihu are the teachings derived from both those internal external senses that accord with good. Now, Nadab means spontaneity.
Right. Right. Nice one. Yeah, well, then the word is even more complex than I realise. Nine three nine nine. I'm not going to read it because we are 1 o'clock. And Moses took the blood and sprinkled it over the people, means making a person well adapted to receive it. So you get this idea of half the blood. Yeah. Now this is this. I am going to read it. This is important. This is what half the blood, underlined half, sprinkled over the people serves to mean. Those who are able to receive it. Those who receive it are those who lead a good life, whereas those who do not receive it are those who lead a bad life. Even so, these latter, the ones who, you know, don't want to know, have the ability to see and learn divine truth and also to receive it to the extent that they leave evil ways. This is what half the blood sprinkled over the people serves to mean. Those in evil, though they can see what good or truth is, have no wish to see it because their will finds it repugnant. When left alone to themselves, they fall back to the false notions accompanying their evils in detestation of the truth or good they have come to see. So I got from that the idea that, okay, slaughter your oxen, put half the blood in the bowls and half the blood on the altar. The bowls are going to sprinkle on the people, and the blood that's sprinkled on the altar is the continuing divine adamant provision for those who are not yet or at that moment receiving divine life, because they're so caught up in their own self-centeredness that they are dysfunctional. But God says half of the blood is for them, and half of the blood is for you guys who are in the ability to receive it.
Wow. Yeah.
Isn't that good?
Very comforting.
And scientifically, therefore, God is love. Because
therefore, God is total.
Yes, total
love.
That's you centric.
Yes.
So are you God centric or you're God agnostic? You fancy that, I suppose.
But it's all in us. All those people are in us because part of us can see some truths that we're ready to see and try and change, and another part of us isn't ready to look at quite a lot of stuff yet. That's the stuff in the bowl, the stuff we can't face up to yet.
It's even true historically as well. Like there are things which code into them the truths that those people treasured for future generations to pick up on, called legomenisms, so that this will stay alive, even through periods of where it's got to go underground or where it's just got to be caretaken by someone who's got no idea what it's about.
Yes.
You know, and they come back to life when someone taps
find
into
the
it
depths,
and
reaches
it.
Do you want to hear something else really good?
Yes, please.
have we got a marker, Mark?
Yes, they just... underneath the lectern.
Yeah.
So reading from writing Hebrew is the letter Nun, Daleth, and Beth. Nun means fish, the word Nun. So the Hebrew, each Hebrew letter has its name has a meaning, a concrete kind of meaning. Daleth is a door, and Beth is a house. Now, so you have a fish, to door, to house, okay? Remember, Nadab means teaching, spontaneity, but teachings that accord with good, right? A fish is facts correspondentially.
Mm-hmm.
Right, moving through the door.
An opening.
An opening, yeah. Mm-hmm. And a house is good.
Because you're in it.
So it's about fats moving from the memory.
Yes, well said.
Through the door, which is application, moving through, and
just
becoming
like
something spontaneous.
Yes.
Act.
Wow.
You're part of the life.
Thanks, David.
That's really well done. Yeah.
Thank
I
you.
So envy you, David.
And
you get to spend
not
so much
good
time.
State. Not a good state.
Not a good state. I envy you, David.
Yeah, I envied people who came into it adult years. So, yes, I've no place to talk to you, Paul. Pushing down tone of voice.
But the word, it's like you were saying, it's perfect. Mm. Like the detail in the word. Even the names teach the doctrine.
It's a layer.
Yeah.
Very good.
Okay, a taste of the chapter, and the core meaning is the connection, because it's connecting from God, the laws revealed by God, ultimately the Ten Commandments, which boots them all up, the laws of God through the up and down chapter that we've had today, leading on to the construction of the building of our being for worshipping God, which ensues in the next two chapters. And at 1 o'clock, Sasufi. Okay?
Right.
Thank you very much. And do read the rest of the extracts, because they're beautiful.